Jesus save.
Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening.
Jordan Combs.
Well, then it always moves along too to the conversation of, you know, if you're going to have a belief in a divine being, these types of frameworks, how does that affect your relationship with your divine being? You know, so if you're feeling like you're being punished through miscarriage and or infertility, then what does that say about your God?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think, I don't know if I really have something to add to that, and I think that's partly because my experience didn't go down that path so much, but I know that in terms of the relationship with God and in the context of the plan of salvation, that was something that I did spend a lot of time thinking about. People who've had older children who die all have the comfort of, well, I get, you know, this child had his body and I will get to raise him in the millennium. And that's a big question that has come up with other people I've known, other LDS people I have known that have miscarried, is, well, was this baby here long enough to get their body? Does this count as being their body? Will I get to raise this child in the millennium? Or if this wasn't long enough, then maybe will this same spirit come back to me in a subsequent pregnancy? As in this was kind of a false start, but, you know, this body didn't work right, but I'll get pregnant again, and this child, the spirit, will come back to me, and I will still get to have them in this life. And I can tell you that in all of these people that I've talked with, there is only one, you know, general authority quote that we've ever found that really seems to give any answer, and it's not much of an answer. There's a quote from Brigham Young that says, when the mother feels life come to her infant, or so when she feels the baby moving, it is the spirit entering the body preparatory to the immortal existence. So that's all we've got. If you feel the baby move, you can know that the spirit has entered. And that's a really nice idea, except if you've ever had an early ultrasound, you can see the baby move at, you know, just a few weeks. You can see it really early, far before you can feel it. And so to me, the implication of that quote is that if there is movement, then the spirit has entered the body. And so, one person I was talking with said that this kind of brings up a lot of implications about abortion in terms of, is the spirit there or not? If the spirit was in the body and then, you know, I miscarried, then that spirit was in the body and I should get this child in the millennium. And if the spirit was not in the body, then, you know, when does it come? And is it really a person if the spirit's not there? I think there's a lot of, you know, I don't want to spend a lot of time going into that, but I think there's a lot of really murky water on that issue, and we don't have clear answers about that.
Yeah, and it's not even very clear when it comes to even what we'd consider worthy Mormon women, because when we talk about abortion, I think most people anyway in the Mormon culture would think, you know, oh, that's a sin, that's, you know, we're going to look at that as a sin. And yet, even within our Mormon cultural kind of, guidance, I guess, that we've received, is that if the mother's in danger, right, then that's a time mm-hmm. when there's an appropriate time to maybe, you know, terminate the life of the fetus. And so even within worthy Mormon women circle, whatever we're going to call worthy, so I'm kind of putting my quotation marks around that, because I definitely don't want to make judgment calls here. There is that, you know, where these kind of doctrinal ideas can cause comfort for one woman, you know, saying, well, I saw and mm-hmm. I heard my baby move, so I get to raise that child in the millennium. But for the next woman, right, who's also, you know, temple holding, recommend holding Mormon, mm-hmm. then for her, she's hoping, well, yeah, I hope the spirit didn't come into the body, because I had to terminate in order to save myself,
right.
You know, or something along those lines.
Right.
I just think that this is such, again, a personalized thing about what's going to be comforting to one and right. be very not comforting to another.
It is. You know, we talk a lot about the plan of salvation being so comforting and giving us these answers. And at least in this case, I think it raises more questions than it answers.
Mm-hmm.
The only sort of solution or answer that I can really offer out, and I've discussed this many times with a lot of people, and the only real conclusion that I can offer out of it is that each woman seems to find her own answers, her own beliefs about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I know women who lost babies at, you know, 5, 6, 7 weeks who believe absolutely that they will have those babies in the millennium. And I know women that lost babies at 18 or 20 weeks that believe that they won't. I personally felt, and I can't give any rational explanation for this per se, but I personally felt that one of my miscarriages was, you know, that spirit came to me later as one of my children who, you know, who came to term. I don't know. It's just a gut feeling. That's all I can really say about that. I can't offer anything to explain or justify it. That's just my mommy's gut feeling about it.
Right.
And it's comforting to me to believe it. But I don't think, I mean, there have not been, you know, official doctrinal statements. It has to go back to, I think, just your gut feeling about it, because there really aren't, the church doesn't really offer answers about that.
Well, and going back to your idea too of what's going to offer you comfort, you know, and mm-hmm. if it offers you comfort, and if it's something that's worthy of your you know, energy, then that's of use to mm-hmm. you. So yes, I think one thing that makes Mormons unique also is that I think that we expect more answers from our religion than others maybe expect from theirs. We seem to be, we have a lot of different answers about the afterlife that other religions don't offer, and we seem to feel like we have things kind of figured out and worked out. And so I think when it comes to this particular issue, to not have those answers in place can feel maybe just a little scary or disheartening or just worrisome.
I think it's a little bit of a letdown. We have all, you know, there's all these answers. The gospel has all of the answers about everything. Oh, except this.
Right.
And I think that it's just, you know, it doesn't provide really solid specific answers. And I think that, you know, if these sorts of things, if they bring comfort, if one particular understanding brings comfort, then I think that's a good thing. Everybody, you know, I keep saying this, but everybody needs to grieve their own way. And what works for you and brings comfort for you is an appropriate way to be grieving.
Totally tangenting back to something we talked about before, one of the things that you had discussed going through one of your phases, stages of grief, was this inability to have patience for those who might complain about their pregnancies or their children or things like that. Now that you're a mm-hmm. mother of three, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
Do you find yourself not allowing yourself to give yourself permission for those kind of common complaints of, oh, today was just hard, or today was, you know, difficult, or there was a temper tantrum that you had to deal with? Do you find yourself giving yourself leeway in that regard, or are you still pretty much in I need to be grateful every moment type of mentality?
Well, I mean, I think that a certain amount of, you know, of frustration or, gosh, I'm just really tired today, a certain amount of that is normal. It's par for the course. It comes with the territory. But I do catch myself consciously fairly often when I'm thinking, oh, I'm so frustrated with my kids. And then I think, but at least I have them. It was hard to get them, and I'm grateful that I have them. And so I give myself sort of little reality checks about it, I guess. I am more more tolerant than I was, you know, in the heat of the depression, in the midst of the grief. But I still, in terms of, you know, when other people are really, really complaining about their kids or their pregnancy and their whatever, I'm more tolerant. I still get frustrated with them. With the thought of, you know, I appreciate that you're frustrated with your kids, but maybe your Facebook status should be a little more sort of not quite so, you know, mad, because realize that there's other people that are going to see it who, you know, who can't have kids or who wanted to have kids, or, you know, there's people who are infertile or who are miscarrying or these other things. And so I guess I've sort of moved into, I'm not quite so angry, but I am still trying to help people be aware that, you know, it's okay to be tired or to be frustrated, but let's think about what we're saying in the context of who else might be listening. Because there's probably somebody out there who desperately wants kids to be tired over, you know?
Right. Well, which kind of goes back to some of our Mormon stuff that I think most people at church just assume that, you know, mothering is a very safe topic to broach. And for mm-hmm. a lot of different reasons, it may not be, not even just this issue that we're talking about today, but for a lot of different reasons. So, yeah, I think that's important. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, this is a little bit of a tangent, but this is just something that I have to throw out here in the context of miscarriage and Mormons. And that is that the use of the term D&C in church in reference to the Doctrine and Covenants mm-hmm. ripped my heart open all over again for about a year and a half after I had my first D&C. And I know we just use it. We don't think about it. We save ourselves the extra syllables. But, you know, in seeking to be more sensitive people, more aware of these other people around us, I would strongly encourage people to please say Doctrine and Covenants, or to spell out, you know, doc and cov. It's a couple extra letters. It's not that hard. And it was one of those stupid little things that could put me into just an absolute breakdown. Because it took me back to the fact that I had a D&C. And I've heard everyone say the same thing, actually. It's, you know, it's a cultural thing. We didn't run into it anywhere else. We'd go to church and all of a sudden they're throwing D&C at us. And then we're grieving all over again.
No, I think that's a really good point. And I was... I was once in a ward where they actually brought that up and asked us specifically not to use that and explain the reasons why. I don't know if that was something that was a directive from up on high, where every ward was given that directive, or if it was just something that came to our either stake or ward leadership because of something that was going on locally. I don't know, but I thought that was good that they addressed that.
You know, I find that I haven't had a difficult time making sure that I always use, you know, the more complete names, you know, spoken or written. It's not hard. I think it's just an awareness thing. And people don't think about it. We don't realize that it could be, you know, perhaps a hurtful phrase for other people.
Okay, so moving towards, I guess staying on the Mormon doctrine thing for a minute. Many times we talk mm-hmm. about the things that are not useful. What if anything was useful about Mormonism or Mormon culture that did help through this process?
Well, you know, I mentioned the woman from my ward. She was actually the compassionate service leader, so it was her job. But, you know, she came over, she brought me a meal, and she brought me, you know, she brought me a gift. She brought me something that was for me, that was to be a comfort to me, and then she sat and talked with me. I think that visiting teachers and, you know, relief societies and things are set up to really be able to support people through these kinds of things, and I think that maybe we just need a little more awareness, a little more willingness to talk about it. So that we can be there to support each other, because we have this fabulous system in place. We just need to utilize it in this application.
So in other words, if you're the person who's going through the miscarriage, to be willing to tell the sisters in the ward that you're going through something like that. And then also for the women who are told to react appropriately, to respond
right
as if this right. is a major event in this person's life, not just something to be hushed over or not talked about.
Well, I think the biggest, really the biggest thing for supporting someone who is miscarrying, the very biggest thing is to respond to the level of their reaction. I've known women who miscarried at whatever stage who essentially wanted to just kind of suck it up and move on. That was their style of dealing with it. And however well that worked for them in the long run, I don't know, but that was where they were in the short term. That was, you know, they didn't want, you know, they wanted to go out and have a girls' night and watch movies and eat brownies and not talk about the baby. And then there's people like me that needed to talk about the baby with everybody for hours. That was, you know, that was my grieving style. That was how I needed to do it. And so I think the biggest thing is to talk to the woman. Sometimes she doesn't want to have anything to do with anybody who is pregnant or has been pregnant. She can't bear to be around people that are pregnant. Even if it's a visiting teacher, you find somebody else because she can't stand to be around pregnant people or around babies. And sometimes she desperately wants to be around a healthy pregnancy or a healthy baby and to talk about that. There were times when the last thing I wanted to do was to hold a baby, and there were times when all I wanted to do was to hold a baby, even if it wasn't mine. We keep talking about every woman's different, and so making assumptions based on your own experiences or on what you've heard from someone else, I think it's the healthiest thing, the most helpful thing is going to be to follow her lead and to encourage her to be willing to, you know, to say what works for her. Maybe she really desperately needs to visit somebody that has a baby and to hold a baby, you know? And maybe she really desperately needs to be shielded from everyone who's pregnant and has babies right now.
So from a Mormon perspective, this whole visiting, teaching kind of construct and compassionate service foundation is very helpful as far as having something in place where these needs can be met. What about from a more doctrinal perspective, or, you know, just anything more on the spiritual side of things that you can speak to that are helpful as far as your LDS beliefs that kind of saw you through this?
You know, there were a couple of hymns that were really helpful for me. Just, you know, the words of them. I remember in the middle of Relief Society one day just completely breaking down as we sang I Believe in Christ. One of the verses talks about that, you know, from him I'll gain my fondest dream, and as I strive through grief and pain, his voice is heard, ye shall obtain. And I just completely broke down and couldn't cope for the next, you know, hour. I have no idea what the lesson was about, because I had those lines from the hymn in my head. And the hymn, Be Still My Soul, was one that I sang over and over and over and over, because that was also very comforting to me in terms of a reminder of the atonement. You know, we're told that Christ bore our sins and our sorrows. And that's not to say that you shouldn't feel any grief, but that you can turn to the Lord as a way to share some of it, to find, I guess, additional support. I do feel like that you know, that prayer and hymns and turning to the Lord was something that helped me cope, something that helped me deal with the experiences. And like I said, the plan of salvation in terms of whether I'll have this baby again or not was not really a big part of it, because I didn't feel like that really gave me answers. But the idea that Christ could shoulder some of my sorrow, and that we have promises that even though, you know, we have pains and difficulties, that in the long run, God loves us and things can be beautiful in the bigger picture, even if it's not maybe the picture that we thought that it was going to be.
Okay, so then moving along to, I think you have a lot of good ideas about resources and maybe what would be helpful for those, either the woman who is going through the miscarriage or those around her. What types of pieces of advice do you have? Maybe you want to separate that into two different lists or...
Sure. Yeah, I do have just a couple of lists here. For the mother, and this would really apply to the father too, but I have a short list of things that helped me sort of resume life after my miscarriages. And the first was to acknowledge it. There was a child, the child's gone, but that doesn't make them any less real. For me, it was helpful to name the babies. I remembered their birthdays, even though it wasn't when their due date had been. We buy Christmas tree ornaments, personalized Christmas tree ornaments for each of our children, and I bought angel ornaments for the babies that I miscarried, and those go on the tree along with the other ones. And so I have these ways of acknowledging them and making them part of my family and part of my children, and that was helpful for me. The second thing is to talk about it. A lot of people feel uncomfortable about talking about miscarriage. For me, it made a huge difference. And I think that we shouldn't, if we want to talk about it, we shouldn't be quiet just because somebody else might be uncomfortable. It's a common thing. Like I said at the beginning of the recording, 1 in 4 pregnancies is a miscarriage. 1 in 4, that's huge. And when you do talk about it, I think I can guarantee you that people will come out of the woodwork, other women who will say, yeah, me too. I've been there. I've lost a baby too. The third thing was to find solace in the Lord. I mentioned, certain scriptures and certain hymns were very comforting to me. One of the Psalms really... It just popped into my head in the middle of one of the miscarriage experiences, and that was the one that says, "Be still and know that I am God." And for me, that was what I needed to hear. It was a stop running around trying to figure things out and just accept that I am in control and that, that things are going to work out. I'm kind of a control freak, and so I kind of needed a really in-my-face sort of calm down, sit down, let me deal with this because there's nothing you can do anyway. And so that was, that was one that worked for me at the time. But I think that there is a lot of solace that can be found in, in spirituality and in whatever form that it takes for you. I found it really helpful to associate with people who understood, other women who had lost children, people who were kindred spirits and who really understood what I was going through. I think that it's really, really worthwhile to seek grief counseling if you need it or want it. That was something that was not an option for me at the time. I think it might have been helpful for me. But, this is still grief. Just because it was a teeny tiny baby doesn't make the grief any less valid. And I think sometimes people say, oh, but it was just a little loss, as though maybe it doesn't warrant, professional assistance. But if you're grieving and you feel like you need help, then you should get help. So, and you just have to be willing to give it time. It just takes time to get through all of the stages and all of the parts to get to where you can, adopt that new normal.
Right.
So that's my advice to people who are miscarrying. There are, I mentioned finding people who can relate, people who've been there, and there are some online resources that are places that a person can go. One of them is the SHARE Network, which is at www.nationalshare.org, and I personally have not really spent much time there, but I've heard several people recommend that very highly. And the other is the organization that I was involved with founding, and that's the Amethyst Network. And our intention with the Amethyst Network is
can
that
you
we
give
are...
The, can you give the address for that?
Oh, yes. That's there's no W's. It's just, HTTP colon slash slash theamethystnetwork.org. Amethyst is A-M-E-T-H-Y-S-T, like the jewel. And our intention there, and we're still working on getting spread across the country, but our intention there is to provide in-person support across the country. So like a doula that could attend a birth, our hope is to have volunteer doulas across the country, and they're either trained doulas or women who've been through miscarriage. We call them peer doulas, who, you know, we have our listings. They're on the website, and you can look up your state and find your region and find someone near you that, if you're going through a miscarriage, you can call them and they can come and be with you, whether it's, you know, someone to be there with you just to talk about it, someone to maybe, you know, help you with sort of dealing with life for, you know, for the first little while, someone who's there for a phone call, someone who's there to, you know, watch a movie with you and make a batch of brownies and get your mind off it, someone who's there to talk with you about what to expect physically, just, you know, someone who has been there and who can be there with you. That's our big goal with the Amethyst Network, and trying to provide in-person support. I've had experiences with friends who were on the other side of the country, and all I could do was talk with them, you know, on the phone or online. And I thought, I really just wish I could be there and just give them a hug and, you know, make them dinner or something. And so that's kind of where the idea came from, that we felt that there was a need. And as I started talking with other women about, I feel that there's a need, and they said, me too, count me in, let's make this happen. So
that's fabulous. So just like a doula would be there for a delivery of a birth, this is a doula who could be there during the miscarriage process itself and walk you through that and educate you and provide support.
Right.
And, see if you need more in-depth medical care or things like that.
Right. And I should clarify that a doula is not a medical provider. So don't ever think that she is. But the hope is that there are some women who have the often an ultrasound. They'll have an ultrasound, which, you know, shows that there is no heartbeat. And so they then have the option of, you know, sometimes they'll do the DNC, or sometimes the doctor will give them a medication that essentially induces labor. And so they sort of take the medication and go home and wait for the miscarriage to happen. And so in those kinds of cases, the doula could be there with them for the waiting, could be there with them through the physical process, which, like I said, can be a lot like labor. The doula also might be able to, you know, to help with evaluating decisions like, should we go into an emergency room? Is this a lot of blood? Should we be concerned? Like I said, not that they're a medical provider, but maybe that there's someone that could weigh in on some of those kinds of things. I think a great benefit of a doula is that, not that they're not emotionally invested, but they're not emotionally invested in quite the same way. And so I think sometimes they're able to be a little more objective. You know, and they can be really helpful in some of those decision-making kind of things, in terms of they know what sorts of options and resources are available, and can be helpful as well as supportive.
Well, I hope this takes off. And I would assume that if you are either a woman, as you're saying, that you're trying to help through this, or if you are a doula or somebody who'd be interested in providing those types of services, that they go on and contact you through that website, correct?
Yes, they can. There's a place to contact us. And like I said, we're looking for people who have trained as doulas, but also mothers who have experienced miscarriage. We feel like the peer doula can be a very, very helpful person in this, you know, in this context.
Okay. So can you speak briefly on how to incorporate the children in the home, as far as what kind of advice do you have for parents like you, or maybe with older children, as far as how to speak with them about the matter?
Oh, that's a really good question, and that's not one I had really you know, thought about or prepared to talk about very much. My oldest son at the time when I was miscarrying was 3, 4, and 5. And so the things that we discussed with him were fairly simple. It was, Mommy was going to have a baby, but the baby wasn't okay and the baby died. And, you know, it was born very, very much too soon. And, you know, so the baby, you know, the baby died and wasn't okay. I think back to when, you know, I was the child, and I think that the things my parents discussed with me were also very simple. You know, similar kind of thing, that the baby wasn't okay, the baby died, we're not going to be having a baby. If the kids are small enough that you hadn't really talked with them about the pregnancy yet, then it can be hard to talk with them about the miscarriage. But I think that they do deserve some kind of an explanation, particularly if Mommy is a wreck. I remember that was one thing that we told my son, was that, you know, when the baby was born, that it was hard for Mommy's body, and that Mommy is tired, and that, you know, that we're sad that the baby's not going to come be part of our family. And so, you know, something that we think about is we miss the baby, and that, you know, that we might be crying about it or that kind of thing. I don't, you know, I think it is common for children to wonder if they are somehow responsible. Depending on their age, some children have some sort of negative or ambivalent feelings about a baby. You know, they don't want to be displaced or that kind of thing. And so I would say, personally, I'm not inclined to plant the idea, but if they say something about, is it my fault or did I make it happen, then obviously to put those concerns to rest, that no, it's not, you know, it's not anybody's fault. It just happens sometimes. Children are really sensitive. And I remember my son being very concerned about me, and you know, we told him the baby's not okay, and so okay, he knew the baby wasn't okay, but then he was very, very concerned about me. He had seen that there was blood, and he was very concerned about whether I was okay. And so it took, you know, a lot of assurances that yes, I was okay, and that, you know, that my body was tired and that I was sad, but that I was going to be okay. So I think something that comes up also sometimes is that children worry that if something happened to the sibling, that something might happen to them. Hmm. And there again, that's not something where I would plant the idea with them. I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't say, hey, don't worry about, I would wait. And if they bring it up, then, you know, then I would try to alleviate their fears.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point that for some children, they've seen some of it, you know, and it's traumatic for them, mm-hmm. as well, especially if there's bleeding or, you know, that fearful response that everybody responds to with at first. And I think one thing that I would normalize, too, is that children usually play out their trauma. So, in other mm-hmm. words, they may play pregnancy, and they may play the fact that the baby has died, or they may play that they're bleeding. They may play out some of those things, especially younger children, you know, 10 and under. Mm-hmm. And to not discourage that, to see that as a form of processing through trauma, that's mm-hmm. actually a very healthy way to, kids, you know, aren't usually ones to sit down and talk about their feelings. Like right. maybe adolescents or adults are, they'll usually just play out their feelings. And so to not be disturbed if your child is doing that, I think is a good
I think, you know, with an older child, you know, you mentioned adolescence, and in the context of Mormon families, it's not uncommon to have, you know, teens and also be having babies. Mm-hmm. You know, to have concerns about, is this kind of thing, you know, is this something you'd inherit? My mother had a miscarriage, so I will too, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And with the very rare exception of, you know, there are some genetic conditions that might, you know, might predispose one toward having, you know, difficulty maintaining a pregnancy. But in general, it's not, you know, it's not something that's inherited. It's not, you know, if your mother had a miscarriage or if she had 10 miscarriages, that's not an indication that you are more or less likely to have a miscarriage. You know, my sister has several kids and has not had any miscarriages. I have fewer kids than she does, and I've had a whole bunch of miscarriages. So, you know, I think that might be something that might be a concern of perhaps an older, you know, maybe an older child, that that maybe this is something that could happen to me too. And there's not really, you know, the science would say no. So.
Right. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. And as your children get older, how do you continue to talk about them as they develop? And have you thought through that at all? Or?
Well, my oldest son obviously remembers the miscarriages a little bit. I mean, he was small, but he remembers them a little bit. And every once in a while, he'll say something about, you know, oh, I remember this or that. My younger sons don't have any memories because they weren't born yet. And it's not, you know, I'm at a place with my grief process where I don't bring it up to them, really. I haven't. They are, right now, they're 2 and 4, so they're kind of small. I do have, like I mentioned, the angel ornaments on the Christmas tree, and, you know, and I'll tell them these, you know, we had babies that died, and these, you know, here's your ornament, and here's the ornament of, you know, these other siblings. But I haven't really brought it up very much. My oldest son is 11, and so it is something where we have, it's come up a couple times. He's asked questions, or he's asked me about my memories or mentioned his memories, and so we'll talk about it a little bit. And I kind of go with the answer the questions that are asked. I'm not one for a lot of these kinds of things. I don't really bring it up. I wait until they bring it up, and then I just go, you know, wherever they direct the conversation, and I try to answer their questions and just, you know, discuss their concerns. But I haven't had a lot of conversations with my younger sons. And as I, you know, complete my training, to begin, you know, being a doula, and especially, you know, trying to work with women and with families who have experienced grief and loss, and, you know, I expect that's something that will come up more with my kids. You know, why do you work with these people in particular? And you know, talking about some of that. But I think I would say the same kinds of things that I, you know, that I told my son when he was little. Sometimes, you know, sometimes babies die and we don't really know why, but it's hard, and it, you know, it hurts our hearts. And so I want to try to help those people that are hurting.
Well, I'm a big fan of the open communication and, you know, naming children and all those kinds of things that I think are very useful for people to kind of go through that stages of grief process. However, there's mm-hmm. people who would push back and say that's morbid. What would you say to that?
You know, everybody knows somebody that's died, and sometimes they live for 100 years, and sometimes they live for a few hours, and sometimes they don't get to live outside the womb, but they were still a real person to you. I'm a different person because of having been through this experience. It's shaped who I am and the things that are important to me. And so I can't just pretend that it's not there. I would say that death is part of life, and I don't think it's morbid. I don't think it's morbid to just be honest about, you know, about the cycle of life and the fact that death is part of it. I'm sure it could be approached in a morbid fashion, but I don't think that the topic is inherently morbid. I think that as a culture, we're afraid of death, but I, you know, there are cultures that are much more comfortable with it, and I think that maybe they're really on to something. You know, from a Mormon perspective, we view death not as an ending, but as a step to the next thing. And even though there's a lot of ambiguity about maybe what is going on specifically with, you know, with miscarriage, we still don't view death as an end. We view it as a moving on and a next step. And so I think it's healthy to be willing to talk about it. And for those who are really uncomfortable about it, I would suggest that is, you know, social conditioning, and that maybe that's not maybe it's not the healthiest approach, that maybe we're kind of, you know, letting fear rule us, and that maybe it's a good idea to, you know, to push some of our comfort zone a little bit, and to be a little more open, because for a lot of us it's very, very cathartic and very healing to be able to get some of it off our chest and to look it in the face, I guess, and, you know, to deal with it.
Yeah, I think that for a lot of people, it's that whole kind of myth of, well, if you think about something sad, then you're going to be sad, right? And so let's just not think about it. Let's be happy, you know, let's just move on. And again,
that's the stage called denial.
Right. And so I think this is a good segue for kind of the advice you would give to those who aren't going through it themselves, but know somebody who are, because I think sometimes, although well-intentioned, like you're saying, in order to move on, you have to be able to embrace the grief as well. So it's not an either or, it's an and. So give me your list for the others, for the loved ones and the friends and the people who, you know, want to help and sometimes feel very helpless in knowing how to help and are mortified when they think that they've done the wrong thing. So I understand there's a lot of anxiety around that as well.
Yeah. There is a lot of, I want to be supportive and helpful, but I don't know what to do.
Right.
I want to begin by saying that I was on a message board for mothers who had lost children for support. And I raised this question there. What was helpful? What was not helpful for you? What do you wish people had said or done? So this was a list that I came up with other mothers. And so I have four parts. I have what to say and what not to say and what to do and what not to do. And this is, you know, this is based on, like I said, the experiences of several of us. And I do want to mention that several people commented that it makes a difference who is saying or doing the thing. For example, some moms who feel really awkward about a hug from someone they weren't very close to, but they really craved hugs from family members or close friends. One person said that she really appreciated when a close friend, you know, reminded her that miscarriage is nature's way of natural selection, but that she would have been really hurt if a more distant acquaintance had said that. Mm-hmm. So keep in mind your relationship with the person in terms of how maybe personal you get. But I wrote all of these up on a blog post, and it's been about 4 years ago, and I get Google hits on that blog post frequently, like probably at least every week. Somebody Googles what to say when someone miscarries, and they get my blog post.
And your blog, I don't know if you've mentioned it. It's called Mindful Serenity.
Oh, yes. And the URL is brightonwoman.blogspot.com. So it's brightonwoman.blogspot.com. And it's the title of the blog is Mindful Serenity. And I have, at the top of that, there are a bunch of tabs to the pages. And there's one of them that is specifically about miscarriages and angel babies. And that has... that page is sort of an index to all of the things that I have written about miscarriage. So, right there at the top, you can just click that tab, and it kind of has everything right there in one central place. So starting at the top with things that are helpful to say. I'm sorry. I love you. I've been thinking about you. It's good to acknowledge the baby. If you have a conversation with them, don't avoid the topic. Just say, you know, I heard that you had miscarried, and I'm so sorry. You don't have to talk about it. You just have to acknowledge that you know and that you care. If you've ever miscarried, tell her so that she doesn't feel so alone. You can tell her the things that helped you, because they might help her. And even if they don't, she will probably appreciate the sentiment. Still talk about the pregnancy. Just because the pregnancy ended in a tragedy doesn't mean that it was any less of a pregnancy. So you can still talk about symptoms or how sick you were or how you told people or what weird things you craved, because it was still a pregnancy, and it's good to validate the pregnancy experience as well as the loss experience. Some things that you should never, ever, ever say. At least you have other kids. You would never say when someone's parent dies, oh, well, at least you have another parent. Don't ever say, oh, well, you can or will have other babies later. At least you know you can get pregnant. Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. At least you know you can get pregnant. Well, it's nice that I got pregnant, but, you know, I didn't get a baby out of it. Oh, at least you were only however many weeks along. At least it wasn't a full-term stillbirth. You know, thus and such would have been harder. It would have been worse. I don't want to know what would have been worse. I have a valid grief, you know, in the experience that I had. Oh, you're young enough, you can have lots more babies. You know what the scriptures say, that, you know, we can have whatever. That's not what she needs right now. She needs you to validate her grief. And I think a lot of these are ways of sort of trying to brush off the grief.
Saying, yeah, standard, oh, well, piece, you know, a standard piece of advice I give is don't give Mormon condolences to Mormons. Because, you know, we already know that stuff. So don't tell somebody, oh, well, you can be with them after this life. Well, I thank you. I know that. But that doesn't mean that I can't, you know, cry my eyes out right now. You know,
I'd really like to have been with them in this life. Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. To say, you know, same kind of thing. Oh, you know, they're in a better place. Oh, it wasn't really a baby yet. That one kills me. I felt like it was a baby. So what do you know? You didn't have this baby in you. And the you need to move on or get over it. Another thing that you should never say is nothing. If mom knows that you know and you don't say anything about it, then it hurts that you're avoiding it. And, you know, like I mentioned, don't use the term DNC. I would also strongly advise to never, ever use the medical term spontaneous abortion. That is the technical term for a miscarriage. But because the word abortion to us means, you know, a voluntary termination of pregnancy, then when I hear that word, at least for me, it makes it sound like the baby wasn't wanted and I wanted kids. And so for someone to say that I had a spontaneous abortion, hurt. I don't care if it's a technical term. It hurts.
It's a trigger word.
So somebody needs to tell the doctors this because they don't get it. Mm. The things that you can do that are helpful. Bring over dinner. Don't ask. Just do it. Come over and clean the house. Don't ask. Just call and say you're coming. Come over and talk. Talk about the baby if she wants to. Talk about anything except the baby if she wants to. Listen. Give hugs. Acknowledge the baby as a baby. Acknowledge the dreams that are no longer there. Help her find distractions if she wants them. Movies or books or projects or things to go do. And don't distract her if she doesn't want it. Bring her a little gift, something that's for her, like a candle or cookies, or, you know, I mentioned my friend that brought me the snuggly fleece blanket, and she said it was a hug, and that was the best thing that anybody did for me. If she has other children, help take care of them. Remember that this is a postpartum period, just as if the baby had been full term, and she needs some peace and some rest. Pray for her and for her family. And if you have been there, you can help her know what to expect physically in terms of if she is miscarrying on her own or if she's having a DNC, maybe something about what to expect with afterwards in terms of if she's wanting to try again. Those were all things that were helpful for me, and I had to seek out that information because there was no one that I knew that could tell me those things, and I wanted to know those things.
Are you able to share really quickly what some of those things were as far as, or are we going to get too medically, like that's another 2 hours?
We've talked about some of those things in terms of that, with a natural miscarriage, which is, you know, miscarrying without medical intervention of any kind, that it might be you know, a lot like a heavy period, and it might be a lot like a labor, that, you know, that there's a huge variety there.
Is there,
you know,
an
with
amount
the DNC
of...
that...
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
No. Oh, I was going to say that with the DNC, it's a pretty simple outpatient process, but, you know, sort of a brief what to expect in terms of, you know, there's some cramping and light bleeding after, but the process itself is not typically difficult. There's not typically complications, that kind of thing. You know, in terms of after the fact, you know, usually there's some postpartum bleeding for a while, and you know, a little bit's normal, but a lot is problematic. And some of the guidelines there are similar to the guidelines for postpartum with a full-term baby in terms of how much is too much or is dangerous. I know a lot of women who, if you're wanting to get pregnant again, they have said that first month, the first cycle after a miscarriage, it is, anecdotally, it seems to be a good time to get pregnant. A lot of women get pregnant in that first month after a miscarriage. And I don't know if there's still pregnancy hormones, so the body kind of thinks it's pregnant and sort of is more accepting of a conception. I don't know. I just know a lot of people that have gotten pregnant easily in that first month.
And are there any sexual limitations or anything like that after miscarriage?
Typically, they will advise, especially in the case of a DNC, they will advise pelvic rest. The doctor that I had always said pelvic rest until the bleeding has stopped, which in my case was usually 3 or 4 weeks. But there's some variation. Personally, I would say until the bleeding has stopped or until you feel comfortable with it. That is one thing that we didn't really go into, and this could be a whole other discussion of how miscarriage can affect your sex life in terms of your marriage relationship. If you desperately wanted the baby and then feeling like, well, that's what got me into this whole mess in the first place. Trying to conceive can be really hard on the other aspects of a sex life in terms of, if you're always focused on trying to make a baby, you kind of lose the connection to each other.
The spontaneity of it, right?
Yeah, you know. It's scheduled and it's, you know, it's whatever. It's, there's a purpose here and we've got to get this position. It's, you know, the best for conception or whatever. But if there's been miscarriage come out of it before, sometimes there's a lot of fears about pregnancy. And that can carry into feeling uncomfortable or scared about sex as well. Those are definitely things that can come up and that can really be, really come into the aftermath of a miscarriage. So physically after a miscarriage, it's good to wait. I would say at least a couple weeks and maybe a little longer if you feel like you need it or if you had a difficult, you know, if you are still having pain or whatever, but emotionally it can really throw things for a loop in that department. So,
well, and to know that there are other ways to have sex other than intercourse if you feel like that's something that you mm-hmm. need. I think some women enjoy mm-hmm. that or want that for comfort. And then for those who don't need that or find that not comforting, to know that just because they've stopped bleeding, they may not be ready to have sex, just from an emotional standpoint,
yes.
too. So I think there's just like a wide yeah. range of what different women need or not need sexually after such an event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there definitely is. And that's something where I think, you know, that's the openness and communication with spouse is important. And, you know, I'm scared of getting pregnant because I'm scared of losing the baby again. And so therefore, you know, I'm scared or I'm uncomfortable or I'm worried. But if there are bigger concerns, by all means, you know, discuss with a doctor or with a therapist or with someone, because it's bound to be related.
And even back to your ideas of, joy, like how can I have sex when I'm mm-hmm. still grieving?
Yeah.
You know, like how can I enjoy yeah. myself? Or if the spouse wants it, how can you want this when we're
yes.
still supposed to be grieving? So I think it can be part of that. Not sure how to incorporate both joy and pain in the same time.
And occasionally, again, depending on how the miscarriage went and what was involved, you know, just as after a birth, sometimes there can be physical pain involved. Just depending on how things went and you know, how things healed or whatever. And that would obviously be something where it's wise to, you know, consult a professional. That's much less likely with a miscarriage than with, you know, than with a full term birth, just because the things that have moved through were not as big.
Right.
But that can be a concern, and some of that might be psychological in terms of this painful experience is related to this part of myself, and so I'm now experiencing pain. You know, that certainly can happen too.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to tangent from your what not to do list, but I think sex is definitely...
I think that's a good thing.
...a big part of this, yep. Sure.
It is. So my last section here is the what not to do. Don't pretend that nothing ever happened. Don't assume that mom or dad is feeling fine just because they're taking care of business again, especially if they have other kids or they have a job or whatever, you know. You can only sit around for so long. They're going to have to get things done, but that doesn't mean that they're okay. Don't change the subject away from the baby. If she wants to talk about it, let her talk about it. Let her change the subject if she wants to. In my experience, she probably won't. Don't assume that her family or close friends or neighbors are handling everything. If you know her even just a little bit, you know, if she's somebody in your ward, you can still help. Like I said, the lady that brought me the blanket and sat and talked with me for 2 hours was someone that I hardly knew. And yet, her coming over that afternoon bonded us. I mean, she, you know, she became one of my dear friends because she reached out to me. And don't casually mention that so-and-so is pregnant with number 1, 2, 5, 10, whatever. This is not about pregnancy in a generic way. It's about her baby that is gone. And, you know, in the weeks and months that follow, I think it's good to remember a couple of things. Mom might not feel like going to baby showers. I know a lot of wards throw baby showers. She might not feel like going because she doesn't want to be around babies and pregnant people. Or she may really want to be around babies and pregnant people. So invite her, but don't feel offended if she doesn't come. Don't question her either way. This is really, really, really especially important for babies that are due around the time when her baby was due. If you've got a baby, offer to let her hold the baby. It might be really helpful for her. If she says no, don't push it because it also might hurt too much. That's another one of those where it's a very individual thing. So make the offer and then follow her lead. If you are pregnant, don't hide your pregnancy from her to try to spare her feelings. Tell her at the same time when you tell everyone else.
This is my fourth.
It's hard to not be pregnant when other people are, but it's even harder if your friend or neighbor or cousin or sister is obviously pregnant and yet they never told you. And when you do tell her about your pregnancy, just do it gently. I had a cousin who was pregnant, I think her due date was a week after mine, with my first pregnancy. And I had just made the announcement. And then I made the announcement of the miscarriage. And about a week later, I got an email from her and she said, and we'd been close for years. I got an email from her and she said, I don't know how to say this, but I don't want you to hear it from someone else. You know, I'm pregnant and I'm so, so sorry, you know, for your miscarriage and your experience, but I don't want this to be, you know, an awkward thing. And that was just the right way to do it, to say, I don't know how to bring this up, but I don't want you to hear it from someone else. And that's all you need to do. But I think it's important to not... like I said, to not hide it in an attempt to spare her feelings, because sooner or later pregnancies show and she'll know. And if she's been, you know, singled out, then that can hurt too. I know everything can hurt, but I think just, you know, a little bit of awareness and a little bit of sensitivity can go a really, really long way.
Any thoughts on the pop-in versus the calling ahead of time before you come over? Is that pretty individualized or any?
I would say that it depends somewhat on the person. It depends a lot on the closeness of your relationship with them. If you know that she's a stay-at-home mom, you know, then maybe you could drop by because you know she'll be there. I think that unless you're, I mean, if it's the kind of person that you would drop in on under other circumstances, then I would say you could drop in and just realize that her house might be a mess and she might be in her jammies and her kids might still be in their jammies and, you know, and, but if, you know, if you're someone from the ward, then I would say I would call sometime in the mid morning and say, hey, I am bringing you dinner tonight. What is a good time for me to bring it? And, you know, just tell her, I want to come help out. You know, let me take your kids to the park for a couple of hours. Let me, you know, I would like to come do XYZ for you. What's a good time for me to come do that? So,
right.
I think that's the tack that I would suggest. And, you know, I didn't mention
to maybe probably not push it, I'm assuming. Or to say,
you know, I might push it just a little bit. I mean, like I said, I wouldn't say, can I bring you dinner? I would say, I want to bring you dinner. What time can I drop it off?
Right. You're being directive about your approach.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I would like to come and, you know, help you with your kids or, you know, I would like to come do this for you. When can I come do it? Please. I want to come, kind of a thing. A lot of us, you know, feel we have a hard time accepting service. We don't want to put somebody out. And so, you know, be maybe a little bit forceful about your desire to be helpful, but also say, you know, I'll come when it's convenient for you, kind of thing. So, and that was something that I didn't mention, but in terms of if she does have other kids, older kids, she may find that, you know, a little bit like I talked about with other babies, she may find that she really wants, you know, a little bit of space to be alone, and she would really appreciate you, you know, taking your kids for the day to go do whatever. The kids may appreciate getting out of the house, but she also may feel the need to really cling to the kids that she has as she's grieving the one that she doesn't have. And so she may not want the kids to go out of the house. Now, she may still appreciate some help with them, but maybe, you know, you come over and kind of help with them for a couple hours as opposed to taking them somewhere else.
Right.
So it's another one of those individual things where just say, you know, I would like to help. I can do this or this or this. You know, what's best for you?
Like give two or three options. Yeah, that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. Well, Jenny, this has been fabulous. I just love all this information, and I think it's so useful and helpful. Is there anything else that you feel I'm not asking or anything else that you'd like to finish up with?
You know, I think that we have this taboo about miscarriage in our culture, and I think it's because we have this taboo about death, and we're scared and we're uncomfortable about it. And I think that a lot of people who are grieving have their grief exacerbated by the fact that we don't have the good education or the good support. So I've been trying for several years to reach out through my blog, and I'm hoping that I can reach out to people. You know, I'm really excited to be part of a big podcast like this that hopefully has a big audience that we can reach out to people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll make sure that we link to all the different things that you mentioned. And I think it's so important to have resources. So I so appreciate your time and willingness to come on Mormon Stories and do this with us. So thank you, Jenny.
I'm excited to do it.
All right. We'll talk to you soon then.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening. Over
Chardon compass came from thee. Jesus Savior, pilot me unknown way. Hiding rock and treacherous shore, chart and compass came from thee, Jesus Savior.